All right, we're in Acts chapter 20, finally. Actually, I mean, I say finally, not because of our schedule, but because we've been just tracking all the way through the first 20 chapters of Acts all through this semester. But we're now in Acts chapter 20. What have we just finished in Acts chapter 19? Ephesus, the city of Ephesus. What happened in the good old city of Ephesus? Yeah, we just came off of the riot, which was surrounding what issue in particular? What's it, who? Artemis, yes. I thought I was looking for the word Demetrius, but Artemis is accurate as well. That's why I was like, that's not how you pronounce his name. Yes, Artemis, who Demetrius was intricately woven to because he was the silversmith that was making tons of money off of Artemis. He convinces the people that what was done legally to them, to him, the loss of his money because people were converting, is illegal because it is shaming Artemis of the Ephesians. Now, that's not entirely accurate. I just remembered I needed my PowerPoint. That's not entirely accurate what he was, what's the word? Telling people that she was being shamed, but he was doing it in a way in which he could accomplish what he wanted to accomplish in a manner that was actually legal, but not totally legal. What ends up stopping the riot, though? City clerk. Who is which guy? Why is the city clerk, why could he stop a riot? He is the liaison between Rome and the city of Ephesus. Therefore, he holds the power or the iron fist of Rome, where all he has to do is snap his fingers and Rome can come there to make sure they accomplish peace, which is normally done through quite a lot of violence. So the city clerk says, whoa, that's terrible color. That's not what he says. My word. Awesome. Well, it's just going to have to be bad color, friends. So he stops the stuff, which is a good thing because Paul probably would have died had he not. Everybody disperses. And now we're in chapter 20, verse 1. When the uproar had ended, Paul sent for the disciples and after encouraging them, said goodbye and set out for Macedonia. Macedonia is what region? Well, I'm glad you asked because it's this one. Whoa, it's blood red, freaking out. Okay, we're over here in Ephesus, and he's going to go up into Macedonia. Macedonia, why is he going up there? What does chapter 19 tell us about where Paul is actually headed? Where does he want to head? Back to Jerusalem. But he's going north instead of down south for what reasons? We gave two yesterday and there's a secret hidden third one that I haven't given you. But what were the two we talked about yesterday? To check up on his churches. That he planted churches all the way from Ephesus. Remember, this is the region he wasn't allowed to go into, as well as Bithynia. He ends up going over here to Troas, where he picks up one friend that we'll meet here in just a bit. Goes on up to Philippi, Thessalonica, Berea, down to Corinth and Athens. He's got churches in these places. He's going to go back and visit them. Also, in order to get back to Jerusalem, there would be, in essence, if he wanted to hit all the churches, going that direction would make a lot more sense as well, because he could hop on a boat and travel 100 miles a day at some point. Here is the third option, the hidden third option. He's also taking up an offering for the Christians in Jerusalem. That's also what he's doing. Where do I get this? 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verses 1 through 3. Paul writes this. Now about the collection for God's people, do what I told the Galatian churches to do. On the first day of every week, each one of you should set aside a sum of money in keeping with his income, saving it up so that when I come, no collections will have to be made. Then when I arrive, I will give letters of introduction to the men you approve and send them with your gift to Jerusalem. So one of the reasons why he is going through these churches is not just to encourage them, but that is one of the reasons. It's not just for speed's sake, that is one of the reasons. But he's also collecting an offering for the churches of Jerusalem. Why would he do that? You have a question first? Go ahead.
Yeah. What was that passage?
1 Corinthians chapter 16, verses 1 through 3. Why would he be collecting an offering for Jerusalem? B- There was possibly a famine going on around this time period. We're in around 55 to 57, although more than likely the famine would have been over at that point. You don't know what some of the residual effects of the famine were. So it is possible that maybe it was just to simply help them out. What other reason would he possibly be taking up an offering for the churches in Jerusalem? Yes? I can't hear you. What did you say? Ah, that's a good idea. Because if you are teaching the controversial message to the Gentiles about they don't need to be circumcised, that they're allowed to be in the kingdom of God, one of the ways in which you could assure the churches in Jerusalem that are not comfortable with that, that there needs to be goodwill between them, is if the churches of the Gentiles take up an offering and give you tons of money. It's one of those things where, man, there's just something about it where the church in Jerusalem are like, man, we hate them and they're showering gifts on us. Well, that's awkward. You see how that could happen? There's a part of it that Paul may be just saying, hey, you know what? Bottom line is this. They are living in the land that God gave the nation of Israel years ago. And they are the forefathers, the ones that have brought about the Messiah. And therefore, we do, even if they treat us with disrespect, we need to treat them with respect. And he says, so let's take up an offering for them to continue to mend this relationship. Because the more we shower gifts on them, the more hard it will be for them to keep launching bombs at us. Now let me say a thing or two about tithing or about money in the churches. Notice, Paul doesn't ever use the word tithe in 1 Corinthians 16, 1-3. He's actually saying the biblical concept of tithing really isn't a good Old Testament or a New Testament principle, to be flat out honest with you. In the Old Testament, there were multiple tithes. It wasn't just one. As a matter of fact, more than likely, the percentage that they were giving in the Old Testament was around 24.5%. So there was a tithe for this and even a tithe for this. And once you added them all up, if you really wanted to look at the overall income that was being given, it's almost 25%. So, the whole concept of tithe, the 10%, is not bad, but just notice it's not an Old Testament principle. And really, New Testament doesn't ever really affirm the tithe. The New Testament actually says, give everything. And the churches there, they would have been giving to the Jerusalem, not out of their tithe, but on top of what they were already giving for their own community to take care of their needs. So, a lot of times people complain, even whenever the churches ask for 10%. I'm saying you better stop complaining, number one. You got tons of money. Number two, I mean, even just giving 10% is actually way less than what they were giving in the old and the new. So let's just relax. You really want to become a New Testament church? Really? Well, then let's compare how they were giving compared to how much we are giving. And let's give to the same things that they were giving to. Am I against a church building? No. Am I against a hired staff? No, not at all. I think you should pay and take care of your staff and your church building. However, the percentage of our budgets that go to those two categories is ridiculous. It's ridiculous. It is out of control. You should not have 80 to 90% of your budget wrapped up in those two things. That is not a New Testament principle at all. You want to know what they had 70% of their stuff tied up into? The poor. Sorry, they did. And a lot of people don't like that because, hey, if they're not willing to work, we're not going to give them money. Okay, that's dumb. Well, it comes from 1 Thessalonians and 2 Thessalonians. Read it in context, please. Because he's not actually arguing for capitalism, believe it or not. What he's saying is, we are a benevolent community, and there's some of you that actually could be contributing to the benevolence, but instead you're taking advantage of it, and that's the problem. But there are some people that cannot contribute to the benevolence, and we should be taking care of them. That's why let me just kind of undo what I said just a minute ago about giving our money. I don't believe that 10% is enough for some people. I believe they need to be giving way more, especially if they have more. But I'll say 10% is way too much for some people. I was talking to a single mom once, and she's like, I'm trying my best to give 10% to the church. And I said, don't. Stop giving 10%. That's ridiculous. You need to take care of your kids. And we need to be giving you more than 10%. Let us take care of you. I appreciate your gift. She's like, no, I want to give. That's fine. If you want to, I'm not going to stop you. But I'm telling you, my heart for you is stop giving 10% because you can't handle that right now. You see the heart in that? It's not a requirement. Because honestly, sometimes people can justify not giving much just by giving 10%. And some people are killing themselves by trying to give 10%. And both are wrong. What did the church give to? Well, let me read you a couple things. In the early church, Tertullian, one of our church fathers, writes this in Apology 39, in case you want to know the reference. Tertullian, Apology 39. He's describing what the early church was giving their money to compared to what the pagan temples were giving their money to. He says, for the money, for the funds, are not taken thence and spent on feasts and drinking bouts and eating houses, but to support and bury poor people, to supply the wants of boys and girls destitute of means and parents, and of old persons confined to the house, such too as have suffered shipwreck, and if there happen to be any in the mines or banished in the islands or shut up in the prisons for nothing but their fidelity to the cause of God's church, they become nurslings of their confession. What is most of the church's money going to? Do I need to read that again? What is it going to? Yeah, the least of these. Pretty simple, and yet ridiculously hard to get people convinced to do that. It's unbelievable. Man, I mean, I can read passage after passage after passage after passage about taking care of the poor from the Old and the New Testament. And people will still just try to write it off as a social gospel or as some hippie agenda. What do I do with Isaiah 1? Whenever God gets rowdy, he gets real rowdy, where he even looks at him and he says, your sacrifices, your new moon festivals, your Sabbaths, my soul hates, he says in Isaiah 1. Why? And then he goes on and tells him why. Because you're not defending the poor. You're not taking care of the fatherless. You're not looking after the widows. You are serving yourself and not the ones I truly care about. Or I could read on Matthew chapter 25, when the sheep and the goats are separated, based off of what issue? How they took care of the least of these. It is a consistent principle throughout the Old and the New Testament that what we do as a church is take care of those that can't take care of themselves. That's what we do. And yet you can't convince churches a lot of times to give as much to the poor as they do to a building. I'm okay if you have a big building, but if you spend $90 million on a building, in the next 5 years you better spend $100 million on the poor. You hear my heart in that? I'm not saying to have a big building, because I know the ministry that goes on in those buildings. But you can also convince people that that's our goal. To get a big church in a big building with a big staff. No, that's only a good goal if that actually serves to function to minister to the least of these. Period. And I will go to the cross on that one. I will fight for that cause. No problem. Why? Because I have a couple of scriptures that'll back that up. Is this making sense? What did the early church do? They served the least of these. Both the least of these that were their own and outside of their own. How do I know that? Because of an emperor in 362 that gets really ticked off with the way in which the church is dealing with and taking care of the poor of the Roman Empire. 362, the Emperor Julian's writing to the high priest of Galatia. So he's writing to this region, and right now we're in this region. Notice how close proximity. He's writing to the high priest in Galatia, and this is what he says. He says that the government needs to establish some benevolent programs for the poor. Why? He says, well, the growth of the Christians was caused by their moral character, even if pretended, and their benevolence towards strangers and care for the graves of the dead. And then in a moment of frustration, Julian writes this. He says, the impious Galileans support not only their poor, but ours as well. He said, everyone can see that our people lack aid from us. It is the reason why. Yeah, I'm a little bit frustrated with the welfare system in America because it's not being run by the church. I'm a little frustrated with the abortion issue because the church isn't providing free medical care to give these people that are poor an option. That's why I do love Life Choices. Because they do provide medical care to people. They give them other options. You want to know why abortion happens? It's not just because people are evil and they just really want to kill babies. It's because a lot of times, sometimes, you want to know what 60% of the abortions are attached to? Poverty. You want to attack abortions? Cure poverty. Because what if you have the question of, do I feed the other four kids that I have? Or do I stop feeding all of them and keep this baby? That's a dilemma no one ever needs to be into. But people have to deal with that dilemma on a daily basis. So don't act like the abortion issue is just evil versus good. It's a complicated issue that the church needs to take the stand in by giving the money to the places the money needs to be going. We should have Life Choices places all over this country, not just in Joplin. Because that's the way the church should fight these battles. But we are so content with fighting the battle of abortion by simply who we cast our vote for on the ballot sheet. And we think we've done our job against abortion. Guess what? We've had more presidents that were pro-life in office since Roe v. Wade in the 1970s than we have pro-choice. And guess what hasn't happened? You think that your faith in overturning the abortion issue goes through politics? Church, you've forgotten who you are. When's the last time that the church in the ancient world relied on Rome to get across the agenda they wanted to get across? The church needs to wake up and start doing what the church is called to do and stop relying on their governments to do it for them. Oh, it's my Christian right to vote. It's my Christian duty to vote. No, it's your Christian duty to take care of the least of these. And voting on these issues consistently gets us nowhere. So start pouring your more money and your time into something that will really change the world for Jesus. Because politicians will make legislation like this, checking which way the wind is blowing, and that's where they will move. And if you expect your government to carry the agenda of Jesus, you've simply misunderstood what this world is about. You just don't get it. What's the church giving the money to in the ancient world? The least of these. And what was happening then? The church was exploding. You want to know why the church in America is consistently on the decline? Because we're not being obedient to what we've been called to be. We're fighting the wrong agenda. Whenever Angelina Jolie is no more for benevolence than the church, we've got a stinking problem. You know? Yeah, sure, question.
What did it mean when it said a few times something about caring for the graves? What's that mean?
It means this. How much time do I have? I'll give a brief, inadequate answer.
Okay.
Next hour, I'm actually going to give a more full answer to this, but I'll give you the brief one right now. In the ancient world, if you were poor, you could not bury yourself in an honorable way. You didn't have the money to. So a lot of times your family would incur more shame and loss of dignity because you would just have to throw your family members in a mass grave. You couldn't give them the dignity of buying a burial plot, of allowing your family to be buried together. And there was something called, and I'm not going to explain this term, but free associations. They were politically sanctioned groups that they could raise their money for different purposes, and they could actually meet together in a legal fashion. If none of that means anything, that's fine. There's something called burial associations, and that's more than likely what the churches were functioning as so they could legally meet together and gather their money together under the Roman government. Burial associations, their whole point was is to get money so that people that were poor could come, be a part of this association, and actually receive the honor and dignity from having their family members buried in a way that was not shameful. And the church said, that sounds just like something that we would need to be doing. We're gonna actually pay the money to give this poor family honor through the way they're buried. As a matter of fact, when you go to Rome today, there's the Christian catacombs, and I've walked through them. It's actually somewhat creepy because you're literally walking by through these long caves. It's underground. This long tunnel is though underground, and it's just body after body after body all around you. But it was probably the burial association that the church started. And there's crosses everywhere. They're dug into the wall. There's even a crazy Greek inscription which says something along the lines of, Peter and John were here. They don't really know what to do with that. They don't really know if it's the Peter or the John. I mean, you know. But it's kind of interesting. The Christian catacombs in Rome have that type of stuff going on. So what the Christians were doing was looking around at the culture and saying, what can we do to give dignity to the least of these? And one of the ways of doing it is giving them proper burials. All right. Was there a question? Yeah, Kevin.
Yeah, what if the tithe really isn't an Old Testament or New Testament principle, why do people get so wrapped up in it?
Because it's an easy way to both justify what they're doing and to oppress other people with rules.
Really?
Absolutely. Now, I think tithing is a good starting place, but notice the way I phrased that. Everybody hear that? Starting place.
So what? Like, how do they pull so much scripture? Like, I've heard a sermon on it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The word tithing is there. I mean, and it even actually means 10%. It really does. The problem is there's multiple tithes in the Old Testament. And we know that when you add up all the numbers of the tithes that you're required to give, that it was more than 10%. So whenever he's talking about the tithe of this, that's good. But that's not the only tithe that they had to give. There's multiple tithes. Does that make sense? So we're taking the one passage of tithing and saying, see, they only had to give 10%. Well, no, 10% for that. But what about the temple tax, which is part of their tithe or giving? What about, there's multiple ways in which money was gathered together in the Old Testament as well as the New.
So it's not wrong to give 10%, but it's wrong to hold yourself down for that.
Yeah, absolutely. Here is our goal in giving. That everyone in our community is without need. I don't care what percentage it takes. That's the goal. That's the goal. Everyone is without need. And when we accomplish that, then yeah. Then the percentage is about right. Well, that would take me 60% of my income in order to make everyone without need. Okay. I don't understand the problem. You see my heart in that? So give 60%. Well, then how can my family live? Now, I'm not asking yourself to kill your family. But what I'm saying is maybe your family can't live the way they are living right now. That's what I'm saying. If you're trying to fight for the luxury of your family, so even though while other people in the pews don't have anything at all, I have a problem with that. There's a heart issue there, not a money issue. It's a heart issue. I do have a problem. And I'll just say this flat out. Oh, I'm sorry, I just looked, so we have 9 minutes. I do have a problem when somebody has like a $20,000 ring sitting next to somebody that's wondering whether or not they're going to be eating later that day. That's ridiculous. That's moronic. It is anti-gospel. I just won't back away from that. Because what's the principle consistently shown through us through the book of Acts and throughout all the church history and the Old Testament and the New? Everyone in our community, unlike other communities of the world, in our community, everyone is without need. Everyone. And I'm not saying, therefore, you have no parameter. You know, you can look at somebody and say, hey, this is the fifth time we've given you something, and what I'm noticing is that you could be providing and you're choosing not to. No, there's definitely a conversation, but guess what? We assume that's where the person is the moment they come and ask us for something. Because we don't even know who they are. We don't know their story. We don't know how they got there. And we don't even know what they really are struggling with because we're not involved in their lives at all. We're just not. You're involved in their lives. You'll know what they need. And you'll know when they need it. But man, we're just used to throwing money at things that make us feel good and don't really take care of the right needs that need to be taken care of. And that's never the goal of giving. There is a goal of giving to make sure you release your heart to have a Lord that's bigger than the dollar. The goal of giving is never to make yourself feel good. or to justify yourself before God. You know what I mean? Is this making sense? Man, giving is just bigger than you. How do I know if the person hasn't everything taken need? You get involved in their lives. Next question. I mean, my goodness, that's one of the things like... I'll just even tell you my wife and I, what we do. We do give up to around 10%. I say around because it's a little bit over around there. To our church and to compassion. We have a compassion kid for each one of our kids so that they're spiritually tied to someone that has the least of these. We also give to a couple of other ministries that we feel passionate about that our church isn't giving to. And then we have kind of an extra kind of stash of money that we'll run into people, you know, that, you know, like we had some of our friends that had their house broken into. And there was a lot of sentimental things, a lot of insecurities with that. And so we spent, you know, a couple $100 buying them some stuff, just like games and stuff for their family to take their mind off of what happened. We each have some money that whenever we see somebody on the street, we can give it to them too. And we're constantly just looking for needs. And when we find them, we give it to it. But it's usually people that we know really well, that we know real well. You know, we've had the money to buy some of our really close friends a cheap car. We've had money, and this doesn't go into my tithe. It's just extra money that whenever we find needs, we have setbacks so we can give to it. And I feel like that's the biblical principle. There is a base from which we got to make sure we do help take care of the things that our community needs in order to function as a community. And we go to College Heights, and that's where we give to. But to say that I need to stop and max out at 10%, or that's what God requires of me, is to simply not understand God and not understand what the other church is doing. Just neither one. Does that make sense? Man, I'll be honest with you. My goal is to be so wise with my money that one day, I'm really looking forward to the day that this can happen, and it won't happen during your lifetime, so don't get excited. Well, maybe in your lifetime, just not your lifetime here at Ozark. But, you know, in 15, 20 years, whenever my house is paid off because we've been good with our money and all my debt's gone and we're still living off of one income and my wife's making a second one, I literally want to take my wife's income one year and go in at a certain point whenever students are have all the bills and say, we're going to give $25,000 to take care of as many students' bills as we can. Because that's what you do. That's what you do. That's what we're working towards. Am I saving up for retirement? Kind of. I'm saving up so that one day, if I'm part of a place like this, I can say, you don't need to pay me anymore, I'll just work for free. That's what my goal is. It's not to go to Tahiti or to Hawaii and just spend the rest of my days on the beach. It's just not my goal. It's not my ministry goal at all. It's to use my money to advance the kingdom. One day I want to be able to be a part of and to be working consistently at a homeless shelter and not have to take a dime. I'm trying to leverage where I'm at right now for the kingdom. And that's always the goal with our money. To have no one with any need. And to use our money wisely so that we can pour it back into the kingdom. It has to be our goal. Otherwise, we don't know who we are and we don't know what we're doing. Is this making sense? Make as much money as you possibly can and then give 90% of it away. That's what I'm saying. One more question and then I'm going to breeze through the next 12 verses so that my guest tomorrow won't be freaked out. Yes.
How do you work like the other end of the spectrum, like for the people who are struggling for their 10%?
Yeah, I look at them and say, let me just take care of you. Stop giving. Stop giving. As long as I know their heart. Some people that are even on the other end of the spectrum, I'm going, man, you still worship money. You need to give some away. But a lot of times, I'll be honest with you, most of the people I talk to that are on the end of the spectrum of poverty, they're not worshiping money. We like to think they are, so it makes us feel good whenever we don't give to them. Most of the time, they really are just struggling. That's when I look at them and say, I'm giving you permission to stop giving for now and let us take care of you. But God wants me. God wants you to be taken care of. That's what He wants. Both your heart and your whole self. And honestly, right now, the best thing for you is not to be giving money to the church. It's to be feeding your kids. So you stop, and we'll even give you a little extra to make sure you and your kids are taken care of. That's what I tell them. But I don't tell that to every one of them. Ultimately, I only tell the ones that I know what direction they need to go. But if you don't know them, yeah, then your advice will probably be bad. Okay, we really need to get moving. When the uproar had ended, Paul sent for his disciples and after encouraging them, said goodbye and set out for Macedonia. He traveled through that area, speaking many words of encouragement to the people and finally arrived in Greece. So he goes down to Achaia, the place where, or that region, Athens, Greece, where Apollos was at. Where he stayed 3 months, hangs out for 3 months, probably because that's the 3 months of winter when no one's allowed to set sail anywhere. Because the Jews made a plot against him, just as he was about to sail for Syria, he decided to go back through Macedonia. When you're in a city for 3 months, like Paul is, you usually don't only just find old friends, but you also find old enemies. And that's what happens. Instead of setting sail, he decides to go back up north through Macedonia because the Jews have set up a plot. Following the narrative here? Everybody with me? Okay. He was accompanied by Sopater, son of Pyrrhus, from Berea, Aristarchus and Secundus, from Thessalonica, Gaius from Derbe, Timothy also, and Tychicus and Trophimus from the province of Asia. Now notice something very important here. Sopater, Aristarchus, and Secundus are from the region of Macedonia. Look on the map where Macedonia is, top left corner. Gaius and Timothy are from Galatia. Notice that's in the center of the big region that Asia's on. Then you have Asia, Tychicus and Trophimus, and then Paul and probably Titus come from Greece. What's significant about that is every major region that Paul's planted churches is represented in the people that are traveling with him. Why? Because they're all giving a gift to the people in Jerusalem. And when they go to Jerusalem, there's going to be three things Paul's going to need to do. Number one, when he's traveling with that much money from that many different locations, it's good to have accountability from every location. So the people can go back to those locations and say, Paul, in fact, gave all that money to Jerusalem. Number two, it is a gift from all locations. Therefore, Paul doesn't want to take all the glory from it. He wants to give it to who it belongs to. So when they go and present the gift in Jerusalem, it is coming from all, the people are represented from every region that's giving this money to them. There's a third one, but I don't remember right now, probably because it's not important. So let's move on. Verse 5. These men went on ahead and waited for us at Troas. Stop! What did you notice? Us. Who's with him now as well? Luke. Where did he come from? Where was he last left? Give you a hint. It sounds... Philippi. He's been there for 5 years. And where do they go? They get Luke, and they go down to Troas. Troas. Why is that significant? Yeah, because that's where Luke's from. Homecoming. Then they go back, they sail from Philippi after the Feast of the Unleavened Bread, which is Passover, and 5 days later, joined the others at Troas, where we stayed 7 days. Happy homecoming. On the first day of the week, we came together to break bread. Man, I'm not going to do this justice. Paul spoke to the people, and because he intended to leave the next day, he kept on talking until midnight. More than likely, they came together to break bread as referring to the Lord's Supper, but do not think of a little shot glass and a chiclet. That's not what it is. Think of an entire room full of tons of food and people laughing and talking and sharing stories together. That's what you need to first envision. Second, this probably began at around 6 o'clock after their full work day. And Paul spoke until midnight. Their meal maybe lasted an hour or so. Paul starts to speak. He's speaking for about 4 or 5 hours. Verse 8, there were many lamps in the upstairs room where we were meeting. So you're in the third floor, heat rises, in a place where all of these types of lamps are lighting the place. Notice how small it is. If it's this small, then you're going to have quite a few of them, which means it's going to get pretty hot in that room. And heat rises, they're on the third floor. You're noticing what's developing. Conditions for what to happen? People to fall asleep. Right? Verse 9, seated in the window was a young man named Eutychus, who was sinking into a deep sleep as Paul talked on and on. Luke writes, I love that. Makes me feel good. Number one, that people are falling asleep while Paul is speaking, and sometimes he can even be accused of rambling. Hey, we're friends. When he was sound asleep, he fell to the ground from the third story and was picked up dead. It makes sense why he was at the window. First of all, he's probably hot. Eutychus probably had worked all day long, is in this hot upper room, having a hard time staying awake because Paul's going on and on and on. As he falls into his sleep, he falls out the third floor window, and he falls, and it says he was dead. That's an important detail because Luke's there, and Luke's a doctor. As a doctor in the ancient world, you would know when people were dead. He says he was dead. Paul went down, threw himself on the young man, put his arms around him. "Don't be alarmed," he said. "He's alive." Very appropriate when you're at the Lord's Supper to have an actual resurrection occur. It's not just irony, that's beauty. Because the Lord's Supper points to something more magnificent than just the cross. It points to the empty tomb. And I'm sure that on this Lord's Day was talked about in the city of Troas for years to come. "Hey, Eutychus, remember when you died?" Verse 11. "Then he went upstairs again and broke bread and ate." That was the communion meditation for the day. Eutychus dies, he resurrects him. Paul goes up and says, "Now let's have the Lord's Supper." Verse 12. "The people took the young man home alive and were greatly comforted." Oh, I'm sorry, I skipped a part. After talking until daylight, Paul left. Paul wasn't done preaching. He starts at around 6 or 7. Preaches till midnight, someone dies, he resurrects him, goes back up and preaches until daylight. I love that. And it's kind of ironic that I'm actually saying that and I have to rush because we're 3 minutes over. But nevertheless, I will acquiesce to the laws we put down and obey them. I love you guys. See you on Tuesday, but you do have class tomorrow. And your paper is due. Woohoo!